Joseph, you were talking about the Indians, and it just brings to mind, again, in looking at the American Indian culture, the role of the medicine man, and it just occurs to me that we don't have medicine men in the same way that we once had them, or the American Indian had them.
Well, the medicine man was primarily one who had had a profound psychological experience in adolescence. Let's say the shaman, what's known as the shaman crisis. It's a marvelous subject, this one of shamanism. Typically, the person in early youth is alone, let's say, walking on the seashore or in the forest, and hears a strange music, and it's the music of the spirits talking to him. And a relationship becomes established, and he's got to hold on to that relationship, otherwise he loses his life. Sometimes what's put upon him is a difficult life, and the shaman's life was a difficult one, one of deep psychological responsibilities and experiences, which he himself hardly understood. This is really a form of mystical experience, experiencing areas of energy that are beyond the conscious knowledge.
Can I think of other societies and cultures, and particularly in the Americas, that have ritually used drugs, hallucinogenic plants, and et cetera. And in our culture, we have this incredible drug abuse problem, and it is to some extent due to the fact that we've lost the ritual use of those substances, which really can be used in a way that expands our consciousness as opposed to making us go crazy.
Well, I'm imagining something could be said for that. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but thinking of the way in which drugs have been used and hallucinogens throughout the Americas, and the American Indian system is full of it, this Castaneda brought out. We know a good deal about that now in the Americas. Also shamanism in the North Siberian area, but also in India. When you see the dancing Shiva, that leaf that's in his hair, that leaf-shaped thing, is the hallucinogenic plant, the datura plant. So through vision, one comes to the knowledge of some things within oneself. We've cut that out, and I suppose...
We have the ritual of the cocktail party is about the extent of the ritual we have associated with the drugs in our culture.
Well, that's the sense, you know, of T.S. Eliot's The Cocktail Party, that the performance of the rituals of society can be a religious performance. And in our world, it's not only going to church, but it's also giving a cocktail party that's a religious act. Well, this puts us on a plane with the Buddhist and Hindu traditions, where every act of life, every relationship of life, can be experienced mythologically as symbolic of a religious experience. One finds going into an Indian home as a guest, one is treated almost as a god. The guest is a deity. I mean, that's a religious act, receiving a guest. It's always been thought to be so. The Arab culture is full of this. You know, the guest is under your protection, absolutely, and in the medieval and in the classical tradition as well. And so taking care of your child is a religious act. There's a story connected with Ramakrishna, the great Indian saint of the last century, where a woman came to him and said, Master, I have to admit, I don't love God. This idea has not, as we might say today, grabbed me, you know. Well, he said, is there nothing in the world that you love? And she said, why, yes, I love my little nephew. And he said, there he is. Taking care of him, you are fostering the God principle within yourself.
It's interesting you bring up Ramakrishna. Perhaps if Ramakrishna were around today and emerged, say, in Washington, D.C., they'd probably lock him up very quickly.
Well, he had certain ways of behavior, at least during the time of his sadhana, during the time of his breakthrough into full realizations. He behaved in a quite insane way at times. There were two or three periods in his life when he was really mad for God, and such a person would be treated as insane. And then the adventure would be aborted. They'd give him drugs and things to blow it out, you know, instead of letting it go through the ceremony.
And here's a man who's acknowledged by millions of people as an incarnation of God.
Well, what he had to say was beautiful. I mean, that book that Swami Nityananda translated into English, his Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful experience to read that.
Also, of course, in Tibet, prior to Padmasambhava's arrival, who is acknowledged as bringing Buddhism to Tibet, there was the bone religion, which was the worship of nature spirits and nature mysticism. And you find parts of that obviously ancient bone nature mysticism in Tibetan Buddhism.
Well, the two interact. One characteristic of Buddhism, you see, that is in contrast to that of Christianity as a missionizing religion, is that Buddhism does not eliminate the deities that were there before. It says these deities are manifestation of Buddha consciousness in the mode of this culture. And so they keep them. In Japan, I heard that when the MacArthur people took a census of religious beliefs in Japan, they found that there were more religious believers than there were people in Japan, because everybody was both a Shinto and Buddhist believer. The local deities are manifestations. Well, the Franciscan monks over here in America had somewhat of that, too. These people who are dancing the dances in the Pueblos, you know, the Pueblo dancers, they're Catholics. There's the church right there, and there's the primitive earlier religious system as well. And that kind of thing is it's a powerful force, because the old religion is not refuted thereby. It is sublimated, you might say, and its energies are brought into the new.
I wanted to return, Joseph, to one of the points you were making about the literally amazing capacity of Buddhism to place itself in literally any culture and become a part of that culture and honor and acknowledge the culture of which it becomes a part. It's quite extraordinary compared to other religions.
Yes, well, it's based on a fundamental Buddhist thought, namely that Buddha consciousness is ubiquitous, is everywhere. And the goal of Buddhism is to make the individual aware of the Buddha being, the Buddha consciousness in himself. Also, it accepts what the world produces and gives. I spent about 3 years helping a Tibetan monk write his autobiography. This was about 8 years ago. And he had been a tulku, that is, one who was regarded as a reincarnation of a monk who'd been reincarnating since the 16th century. And he was taken into the monastery when he was about 5 years old. And so his whole life was spent in the monastery. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. And he left Tibet exactly the day the Dalai Lama did. He was in Lhasa, and he was actually at the Dalai Lama's summer palace called the Nabulinka at the time of the communist bombarding of the palace and attempt to take the Dalai Lama and the Dalai Lama's flight, and then the massacre of people in Lhasa and all this kind of thing. It's a hideous story, the departure from Tibet. His teachers had been tortured and murdered, and his schoolmates and friends and so forth, monastery companions. And I've never heard a negative word about the Chinese from that man. I've never heard a negative word of what had happened from that man. It is all Buddha process. And there's that Buddhist idea of what's called mutual arising. Enemies arise mutually, and the situations are of a transcendent source. And I learned from him what religion is. It's a perfectly beautiful thing. Unfortunately, when his book was published, the publisher massacred it, took the whole guts out of it, and just gave us the beginning and the end. Whereas the great thing about the book was it's telling us of all the details of monastery life in Tibet, which now is finished and we'll know nothing about otherwise.
It brings to mind, as you're talking about, that acceptance of, again, the relationship in ourselves between accepting and the wanting to control.
Oh, that's the whole mystery, you know, to have the mind submit. It must try to serve, you know, not dominate life. That's a major point in so many mythologies. The mind dominating life is really Satan. And life speaking through the mind is the power of the Christ. That's a basic thing. It's the Buddha theme as well.
And we have things like wanting to control our environment.
Our relationship to the environment is a bad one because it's been one of exploitation, you know, and we're suffering from that now. I think something's happening. People are beginning to realize this is a dialogue between civilization and its landscape that must be recognized. I think it's beginning to get into the mind now, what's called the ecological movement. It's something that's being realized a little late, and I think not too late.
I want to thank you for being with us, Joseph.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you. I feel I'm talking to a brother.